Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. This is the show where we affirm and celebrate the power of dreams, synchronicity, and creative imagination. We have a wonderful guest today. I want to give you a foretaste, an amuse-bouche of what might be in store in this conversation. I want you to listen to two short passages from one of his books. Here's the first. Quote, "Each dreamer gets a unique image of the soul. And everyone who dreams has this path of knowing the hidden life of the soul." Here's the second one. "A dream provides an exact tincture of the soul, a strong whiff, ammonia or perfume, to wake us from a faint-hearted life." Excellent stuff, poetic stuff, and indeed our guest is a poet amongst many other things. His name is Roger Kamenetz. You may have come across his book, The History of Last Night's Dream, which is a personal odyssey in the realms of imaginal healing, dreaming, dream work, and much else. He probably first became known as a scholar of Jewish mysticism and the dialogue between Jews and Buddhists. He's published several volumes of poetry, including a recent collection of prose poems called Yonder, which I was looking at the other day, very powerful and singular imagery. And I have great pleasure of having a conversation with Roger for the Shift Network Streamwork Summit, which some of you have listened to and might now want to check out. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you, Robert. It's so nice to be with you.
One of the great gifts of your book, The History of Last Night's Dream, is that it encourages us to free ourselves from the thrall from the yoke of dream interpretation, which, as you point out, has ruled the approach to dreams in so many societies that have valued dreams, not only in Jewish tradition, but in many other traditions. And often dream interpretation results in putting something other than the dream in charge of it. It results in suppressing the vital, throbbing authenticity, sensuality of the dream and substituting something more abstract, something more verbal, something that tries to put the dream in a box. Talk to us a little bit about your own odyssey. You've written it in The History of Last Night's Dream, but let's have you talk a little bit about it in your own way. Just let me note along the way, I was particularly delighted in this book by your account, your luminous vignettes of life with Colette El Bouka Muscat, Madame, in Jerusalem. I never met her, but I know Catherine Schoenberg, who I know is a friend of yours as well, and I've read Colette's books. I've heard about her impact on people. And when I was a kid writing my honors thesis, for my bachelor's degree at the Australian National University, I wrote a thesis on French literature and philosophy in the age of the Algerian War. So I came across her family in the history of French resistance in Algiers and in the life of that time. So I really enjoyed greatly your vivid account of Colette with her very sometimes harsh and determined personality teaching imaginal healing on her porch in Jerusalem. So take us a little bit through the odyssey of your own understanding what dreams may be and the flowering of your own, you know, grasp that we need to facilitate the dream, as your mentor Mark Bregman puts it, rather than simply interpret it and put it in a box.
Right. Well, thank you, Robert. I'm delighted that you know of Colette, and she's almost a secret asset, and I keep coming back to her work. I was led initially to her because of what I wrote about in The Jewel and the Lotus, because I was so impressed with the Tibetan approach to visualization. And coming, of course, coming from a Jewish family and ancestry and also religious orientation, I did wonder, well, gee, working with images, is there anything like that within the Jewish mystical tradition? one of my other teachers, Reb Zalman, Zalman Schachter, Shalomi Ledney, said I should talk to Colette. So I came to Jerusalem in 95 and had the encounters I described in the book, The History of Last Night's Dream. And she was really teaching me that what she called the sovereignty of images within us. And I, it's as fresh to me today as it was back then. It's still a very real struggle within me, not only personally, the struggle between, we might say, words or discourse, concepts on the one hand, and these ever-evolving and beautiful images that keep coming up from within us. So that battle, it's still on, Robert. I haven't... Both sides are pretty strong. And I do feel that bringing in this concept of interpretation that you're touching on is important because, you know, if we look at the etymology of the word interpretation, the word pret in there means actually a price or value. So to interpret is to insert someone else between the dreamer and the dream and offer a value for it. It's kind of a brokerage. And I feel, and I know you feel, that no, that the real path is a direct and living encounter with the images in our dreams and deeply feeling them, not explaining them or conceptualizing them.
Right. Let's be very clear, and you make this very clear in the History of Last Night's Dream. There's an inner and there's now the history of dreams, as you put it there. The inner history of dreams is the experiences themselves. Mm-hmm. The outer history of dreams is how they're shared and received by others. I mean, to paraphrase
right.
you and to
right.
take a brief historical view, as a historian, I was initially trained in history. I've spent a lot of time looking at how dreams have been valued and shared in different societies, including the societies where they're valued highly. And, of course, you get into some very dark and murky areas because, on the one hand, in our society, dreams aren't widely appreciated or valued, and lots of people going through a dream drought learn how to talk about their dreams. But in the many human societies where dreams were highly valued and valorized, you sometimes got into the business of controlling the dreams and using the dreams, you know, for political propaganda, to undermine a regime, to, you know, to do all sorts of other things. We're talking now about the hierarchical structured societies. So dream interpretation has sometimes been problematic beyond simply losing the vital vibrancy and spontaneity of the dream. Sometimes it's become part of a social process of attempted control of the imagination. So, you know, anything
right.
that asserts the primal value of the dream image itself, I need to cleave to that, maybe to hold it close like a power or a mystery over a period of time. I love the way that you, quoting the mystics of the Zohar, talk about how Joseph, who's thought of as an interpreter, actually holds his dream. He holds his dream of the erect sheaf, which got him into trouble with his family, but he holds it as a dream of power. In his mind, he abides with the dream until it manifests and takes root in the world. That's one of the many things about dreams that comes through the historical chapters in your book, looking particularly at the Jewish approach to dreams in many societies. I found all of that really helpful and really well stated.
Well, thank you. Of course, the book of Genesis I view as the primal, in the sense of really the original, earlier, or one of the earlier books of the dream. And we have already this conflict between the notion of the dream as interpreted, for which Joseph, the grown-up Joseph, is the avatar, right, the interpreter of Pharaoh's dream. But we also have his father and his dream of the latter, where there is no interpretation, but rather you wake from the dream and the world is transformed. And he says, how awesome is this place, and I didn't know it. Well, he comes to know it through the dream, and I think this is such a beautiful universal dream. Of course, it's a gift to the Jewish people, to the world, but, I mean, it belongs to the whole world, these stories. And so I see right there this this tension between the notion of the interpreted dream and the dream that is a revelation.
Mm. I must say, although you put it so very well from your own experience, I must say, Roger, I don't feel the same conflict between the word and the image in my own dream life that you seem to have felt from time to time, because, you know, like you, I'm a very bookish and literary person, and I find I'm often reading in my dreams, and I'm able to bring through, when I stay with the dream and sit with them in the middle of the night and write from it, and sometimes I bring through pages of text. How much is that the original dream? How much is it something new in hypnagogia? It doesn't really matter to me if the content is good. And I'm forever, like Jung, actually, Jung did the same thing, following the research leads that dreams give me. I'm given a funny word, I'm given a phrase in a language that I don't understand well or don't know at all. In the age of Google, it's easy to follow things up. So I find I am forever following verbal clues. Sometimes they're written, sometimes they're stated in the dream. And that is part of my game with dreams. I mean, we dream in different styles and different modes, don't we? And I guess those of us who love books as much as you and I do are going to have more bookish dreams and more dreams that might set somewhat bookish research assignments than other people. But I don't feel any conflict between the word and the image when my dreams giving me words, sometimes words of power. I mean, sometimes words in languages, in ancient languages, that are real words of power in those languages and open a sort of mythic dimension or even a connection to a living, continuing shamanic tradition somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm forever playing with the words in my dreams. But this is something different from overlaying words of interpretation over the primal power of the image.
Right. I agree. And of course, in writing poetry from my dreams, I learned a way to do it where instead of trying to write directly about the dreams, I wrote from them, from the feeling of them, what I would call the perfume of the dream, and to stay in that state and continue working with that state of mind and let new words come in. So let me make a distinction here that may be helpful, because the word that is, in a sense, a presence in us, right, just as an image is a presence in us and is engaged that way with feeling, or imago is a presence within us, a personified image we engage with feeling. So there's a level of language that is originary or original that's the life of language in us. And when we're engaging that, we're in the poetic mode. There's another use of language as conceptualizing tool, as container, and that mode is the one that I think we both, that at least I'm uncomfortable with and find and struggle with, the encounter with language itself as a creative, ongoing creation, creative activity within us. Does that help a little bit?
It does help. I would say, I don't know whether this is taking you beyond where you are in your approach to these things, but I would say that there's something more about dreams. They require action, not interpretation. They require action. When I say action, I mean we need to do something with our dreams. The dream might be to hold on to the dream and use it like a light in the dark or a fire on a cold day, that kind of dream of power. It might be to be willing to stay with the dream until, as we walk around and around with it, its full meaning reveals itself. It might be to share the dream in the right way with the right people by the right method. I mean, as you know, I follow the If It Were My Dream protocol, which makes it okay for us to say anything in the presence of someone else's dream without purporting to tie it up with a ribbon and give it a fixed meaning. And that's something to do with dream. Find the right way of talking about it, so you build a community of people offering their feedback without trying to control the meaning. And the action might be to do the research assignment. The action might be to wear that color. The action might be, and this is one thing that I love doing and teaching, the action might be not only to stay with the dream, but to dive back into the dream, get your head back inside the dream, try to revisit the space of the dream so you can recover the fuller dream experience rather than just talking about the report. That, to me, is the most powerful way to get beyond the textual approach to dreams, that dreams are text to be read and interpreted, to go back inside the dream through what I call dream reentry and experience the fullness of the dream and understand from inside the dream what is going on and proceed from there.
So I've learned a lot from, you know, of course we had the opportunity to have a conversation on the DreamWorks Summit, and I definitely felt inspired by your action orientation. I'm a kind of sedentary guy myself, but I like I like what you're saying there, and I think you're right. For me, the way in which dreams become actionable is through the feelings, and the feelings come through the contemplation of the images and encounters in our dreams. So, you know, I had a friend, Sylvia Borstein, when she said, don't just do something, sit there. You know, so the idea is that before we can move to action, we have to deeply engage in a contemplation. And I use that word very specifically to mean the concentrated bringing up of an image as a living presence and feeling it more deeply. So from that place, then to act, yes. I do get, though, that your point that, you know, let's say if the dream shows me wearing red, for instance, yeah, why not play into that and try it out in waking life as a way of honoring the dream and continuing the process in waking life? This makes a lot of sense to me.
Let me give you an example of action of a research, in other words, verbal, bookish, sedentary kind, Roger, that came up when I was going through my journal from last year. Occasionally, when I have a day at home, I'll just go day by day through my journal, which contains many things in addition to dreams. And I came across this report from last year. It's a tiny dream report. It's the work on it that might interest you. I dreamed that someone said in the text of a play, I've given the text of a play in my dream, and so one of the lines in the text reads, quote, women are all sexes. This is the heart of the dream. One of the female characters in the play is named Hephaestus. I'm intrigued coming out of the dreams. I didn't put down any stronger feeling than that. I'm giving a very summary version of the report, but it is very short. I think of Hephaestus, you know the name of the Greek smith god, and husband of Aphrodite. And I decided to do some research. Is Hephaestus actually the name of a woman? And what's this scene going on in the play? Because there's a whole city involved here. So I go online. I'm amazed to find the word in essay by an Australian writer and artist from my native country. Her name is Susan Bellamy. She's writing about her creative process, and she confides that she's constructed a city in her mind, an imaginal city that contains a whole studio complex. She meets an inner guide there whose name is Hephaestus. I won't go on with it, but I mean, how likely is it? This all felt absolutely right, and they put on things like plays and entertainments and so on. And by the way, they are they're a lesbian community, so the phrase "women are all sexes" might apply too. So it's a tiny example, told rather breathlessly, of a dream that provided a clue to a community in a situation where people are building imaginal cities and engaging with the guides in one way or another and invoking Greek mythology and playing with the names. And it opened something up to me I would have absolutely known nothing about, except the dream gave me a clue. Is this of great importance? Probably not. But it's the kind of thing that I like to do, because I like this kind of quirky research. So that's the sort of thing I like to do. And Jung was a bit the same. I remember Gerald Epstein wrote about him. Gerald Adler wrote about him, that he once mentioned a dream for Jung in which he landed in India. Instead of discussing the dream, Jung went to the bookcase, got the big Oxford World Atlas off the shelf, opened it to a map of India, and said, "Show me exactly where you landed." So that's some of the research I like to do with dreams. Let's have the names, facts, and details. And very quickly, and perhaps a little too breathlessly, there's another dimension of all of this, which I didn't find so much featured in your book. It might be there more than I noticed, but it's a social feature of dreams. I mean, in dreams, we encounter other people, including other dreamers, including the deceased. You do refer to moving dreams of your own involving the deceased, so I think your longer account of that is in another book. But, you know, I'm a very private person in my ordinary life, except when I'm on a platform or leading a group. But in my dreams, I'm very social, and I think sometimes of the first dreamers of my native Australia, the Aboriginal dreamers, like the Kukuja out in the Western Desert, who, when they listen to a dream, if they're going to ask any questions, they say, "Well, who, what, when, where? Who are you with? You know, where's that waterhole? Were you over that hill? You know, where did you meet the dingo?" Because they understand that we get out and about in our dreams. We meet other people of this earth as well as beyond this earth. I mean, this is a dimension of dreaming which is understood by all the indigenous cultures that I understand, and it's another dimension of dreaming that I think has been rather lacking in the theorizing and in the research, but it's there in the experience of ordinary dreamers. We get out and about, we meet other people, they come visiting us.
So the theme of what you've been saying, I think, is right on, which is the sense of how through the imagination and through particularly dipping into or experiencing the primary imagination that dreams offer all of us, we can find a deeper connectivity with others, and we can discover connections we didn't know existed, like you did with the Australian folks in their imaginal community. So, yeah, I mean, your curiosity leading you from, you know, following the cues and clues of the dream to try to bring this out into the world and see if there is a connection is a wonderful kind of exploration. I think the social dimension of dreaming is really powerful, and you see this with great force at the beginning, especially in histories of religion, you know, where people at a certain phase are all dreaming the same dream. One of the discussions I have about that is for a nice Jewish boy, it's kind of curious, but I have a whole discussion of the book of Acts where this is happening, where people are sharing their dreams and visions or having the same dream and vision. So that's definitely, in the history of dreaming, isn't it?
Yes. Well said, Roger. We're going to pause for a break. One of the things I'd like to introduce when we come back is dreams of the deceased, dreams of the departed. You mentioned briefly in the history of last night's dreams, moving and important dreams of your deceased grandfather and your mother, which I know you wrote about in more detail in another book. I must say the number one reason in my life, in my experience, why people who are not accustomed to talking about dreams, except maybe outside a very intimate circle, have decided to tell a dream is they dreamed of someone in the family or someone close to who has died, and they dreamed of that person, and the first thing they want is some kind of confirmation or validation. So let's move into that area, amongst others, when we come back. We're talking to Roger Kamenetz, the author, amongst many other books, of The Jew and the Lotus and The History of Last Night's Dream. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
Welcome back. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Our excellent guest today is Roger Kamenetz. He's got a course coming up for the Shift Network, where, as you know, I teach many courses. He's got a course on dream work and imagination coming up in December. You might want to look out for that. By the way, if you don't know already, my new course, The School of Imaginal Dreaming for the Shift Network, starts on November 20th. Roger, I introduced before the break the very important theme of dreams of the departed, dreams of the deceased. As I mentioned, probably the number one reason in my life why people have decided to tell a dream who might not have been accustomed to talking about dreams is they've dreamed of someone who has died and they want to know what's going on. Is it for real? What should they do with it? This has been an important factor in your life, has it not? Dreaming of family members who've gone to the other side?
Absolutely. My first book of poetry really came in response to the death of my grandfather, who was kind of an immigrant and a living connection to the whole old world that, of course, was destroyed during World War II. And he came to me in a dream, and there's a poem that speaks to that. And then a few years later, my mother died very young. She also came in a magnificent dream, and I structured a book called Terra Infirma, Shaky Ground, I guess, in which essentially I try as best I could in that time of my life to build an explication of the dream as a way of telling her story. So dreams have always been with me. I think, you know, I've always felt particular wonder at this strange paradox of when our departed, our dear ones reappear. They're so alive. They carry such a quality of living, of life. And this is the mystery of the image, too, isn't it? That the presence of these dear ones in our dreams is so intense and moving, in part because simultaneously there's a part of us that knows that they're not alive, and there's a part of us that is absolutely feeling their life. And this powerful current of feeling that overwhelms the intellect and the skeptic in me is always been deeply moving, and I feel it with other dreams as well, of course, people I work with.
Yes. Well, you put that strongly and movingly, and indeed, it leads me to say that by my observation, the number one reason for human belief that something, call it soul, call it consciousness, survives death has been the dream encountered with the deceased. And the awakening to the fact that one of the things that we ourselves do in dreams is we travel quite naturally to places where the dead are alive. It's a near universal experience when you encounter the deceased to find that they're alive, sometimes well, sometimes not so well, but definitely seeming to be alive. And of course this, when we wake up to what's going on, becomes an education in the fact that something survives the death of the body. They're dead in the sense they don't have a physical vehicle anymore, but they're alive in a different way. When people dream of the deceased as something other than alive, it's usually, by my observations, might get a little bit too esoteric, or rather a little bit too Paleolithic. It's because they're looking at the state of one of the lesser vehicles of consciousness, the heavy energy body, even an aspect of the astral body that survives death but eventually decays and rots away. There's a Kabbalistic anatomy for all of this, as you're probably well aware, but as far as I know, it's not in common usage or common understanding in the Jewish community, and there are vocabularies from the East and from the Neoplatonists and from shamanic lineages, but again, we're not being taught very well about, you know, the vehicles of consciousness, the subtle bodies, so we're not very prepared for all of this. Let me say briefly that in the year that changed my life, which was the year 1986 to 1987, when I was called by an ancient Arondiwana, a woman of power of the Iroquoian tradition, who lived 250 years ago and has historical identity, and I had to learn her language in order to understand her. Another thing that happened that year is my father died in Australia. And he came back again and again to me after his death. He was a good man. He died of complications after botched surgery for a stroke. And he came to me with messages for the family. And they were urgent, they were simple, they were clear. It enabled me to give advice to my mother, which enabled her to move to a happy and sheltered environment for her last years. And then he continued to visit me, and he started showing me his transitions. This went on for many years. And we were very good friends. And I was being given a guided tour of his experience of the possible afterlife. And then he told me he'd made a certain life choice about what he's going to do now, and wouldn't be seeing me in the same way again. Fine, that's it. Goodbye again. Then 3 years ago, Roger, I'm in the hypnopompic state. I've woken from a dream. This is the state in which I spend a lot of time. Perhaps you do too. I love these liminal, fertile phases between sleep and awake. I'm up on a high rooftop, and I think, oh, good, sometimes I can get a perspective on life from a place like this. Sometimes I meet a slightly higher self. My father is there, and I'm shocked to see him, not because he's dead, I know he's dead, but because he told me he'd gone on to do something else, and now he's here in my life again. And I'm right in front of him, and he touches my upper lip with his finger, and he says, go to a doctor and have that checked out. Yes, Dad, so I do. I call the dermatologist. A mole that hadn't healed after a shaving cut is actually basal cell carcinoma. I have a spot of skin cancer. My regular doctor hadn't noticed in general physical. I hadn't thought about it. Something easily dealt with if you deal with it. But it was my father, my deceased father, coming from a long way away, giving me that warning that led me to take action. So when I had the surgery, I raised a glass of single malt scotch. He was a Scottish soldier by ancestry. And I said, thanks, Dad. Now, psychologists might sit around and say, well, that's the part of you that knows that there's a problem putting on the mask of your father. Somebody might call it a disease marker. All of that is good. The result is the same, except I know for certain sure that was my father. So when you have experiences like this, you just lose any ability to have any skepticism about the survival of consciousness. You can be a skeptic about God. You can be an atheist or agnostic. But I think one of the things that happens, Roger, when you get deep into this dreaming is you cease to have any doubt that there's something called a soul or consciousness that can travel outside the body and survive the death of the body. That's one thing that I think if you become a real dreamer, if you're actually doing the dreaming as opposed to sitting around talking about it, I think that's one thing that you decide is for real and your doubts fall away.
Right. So, the kind of work I do, we call it natural dream work, and I'll put a plug in and say we have a wonderful website, thenaturaldream.com. I have about 12 colleagues now on that. We begin at the ground of the experience, I guess the other end of it. In other words, accepting that people, for whatever reason, you've come at this yourself, but they come into looking at dreams from a worldly or waking life point of view, and they continually revert to that mode of skepticism or pragmatism that dismisses the reality of the imagination. So engaging them to getting people to really encounter not the extreme cases, not the extreme, but I'd say the most poignant case are the dreams such as you just told us, or the dreams of my mother after her death, where there's the deepest kind of feeling, where there's what I would call a sacred encounter. And so there's a whole training that goes in as people soften and become more open to the imagination and less constricted by the old stories of the waking life ego. I mean, I view the ego as a narrative mechanism that's imposing normalcy on these extraordinary and wondrous experiences that our dreams are offering us. So, I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying, at least I'm approaching it with people. I'm trying to help them into this.
Yes, I think you make it clear that there are worlds of wonder and empowerment and healing and self-understanding waiting for us if we can put aside the tendency to interpret our dreams according to ordinary conceptions of reality and let the dreams help us to interpret reality itself and to reflect a deeper reality. I mean, that comes through pulsingly in the history of last night's dream. We're talking to Roger Kamenetz, who has a new course coming up to the Ship Network, beloved of many of us. We'll be back to share more about his approach to natural dream work and other things after the break. You're listening to Robert Moss. This is Way of the Dreamer.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. Let's have a moment for plugs, both from me and from our wonderful guest, Roger Kamenetz. My book, Dreaming the Soul Back Home, is now an audio book. Yes, I was finally persuaded to do it. It's an airless cubbyhole of a studio for 3 days and record the book. And you're required, if you're recording a book, to stop being author, editor, or spontaneous speaker and be faithful reader as to the sacred text. If it says it's, you have to say it's not, it is. Anyway, it's done. I'm very excited about it. So Dreaming the Soul Back Home is now available from audible.com and the usual suspects. And if you go to mossdreams.com, you'll find we've put up my very extensive event schedule for 2020. And I have a new course for the Shift Network starting November 20th called The School of Imaginal Dreaming. Now, Roger also has a course for the Shift Network coming up. Why not do both? Natural Dream Work and Sacred Imagination. And Roger, when is that starting?
December 12th.
And what's your website again?
TheNaturalDream.com. That's
okay. Well, talk to us about natural dream work. Talk to us a bit more about your approach and what people will find if they come out to you.
Well, our approach is to begin by really honing in on the actual experiences in our dreams, what I would call the facts of the dream, the events in the dream, and to very carefully bring people to use their dream senses and feelings as ways of being in the dream. So very often in the beginning, part of that work involves making clear the difference between the suppositions or concepts of the dream ego, the dream point of view, and what the dream field is actually presenting. Because I find that, if I can give an example, someone comes to me and says, I killed somebody and the body's in the trunk and I'm driving and I see the blue light in the back and the police stop me. Well, I go back and say, wait a minute, did you say you know you killed somebody, right? I said, well, how did you kill that person? I don't know. Do you remember putting that body in the trunk? No, I don't. I said, well, where does the dream actually begin? Actually, it begins with the blue light in the rearview mirror. So, you see, we're getting to understand what was actual an event in the dream as opposed to what the dream point of view is inserting into it as a presupposition. And by very carefully doing that, we really get people to directly encounter the true events in the dream, which are, I think, that at their height are encounters with beings, with presences, whether animals or archetypal figures, fathers, teachers, mothers, healers, lovers. And by really, in some ways, taking away the interpretations of the dream ego, even inside the dream, is adding in, we help clarify what is actual in the dream. And this is the beginning of the work we do.
Yeah. Well, this is good. I mean, we agree with Mr. Jung, dreams the facts from which we must proceed. Just thinking about the vivid description you gave of the blue light behind the car, yeah, that's revelatory in itself, focusing on that as the moment the dream begins. Another way of looking at it, I'm not going to try to revisit the dream, which is the one that you've worked with and I don't know, but I mean, I might also ask questions if it were my dream or my process, actually, who am I in the dream? Am I my regular self, or do I seem to be in someone else's body? Is it my regular car? What is the scene? And I might, if it were appropriate, leaving aside this particular example and thinking more in general, how did I get here if I'm the dreamer? Was something else going on before this scene or before this episode altogether? How could I find out? Can I go back inside the dream and interview the cop if there really is a cop there? Can I get a statement from the cop about what's going on? So we might play with this from many angles, many slants, but certainly the moment of featuring the blue light back of is a revelatory moment. I mean, that's good work. That's good stuff. I'm greatly convinced that I don't want to look at a dream as a text. Of course, as a historian, I'm compelled to look at lots of texts, dreams from different cultures. We don't have the text. But actually, as a dream archaeologist, sometimes someone who can attempt to use the skills of shamanic lucid dreaming to travel across time and put myself in a certain scene, I can sometimes at least flatter myself that I'm able to enter the mindset of a certain culture and understand where that text came from. Nonetheless, I would probably agree with my more conventional historical colleagues that there is a text in a book, and that is not the dream itself. With living dreamers, we have access to, and living dreams, our own and other people, we can do this. We can plunge back into the dream. I liked your image of contemplation earlier on, but as an activist, I also rather like the sort of Inuit shamanic dreamer's approach in the Inuit in the language of the Angakok, the Inuit shaman. The word for dream, which I love, it's kutsaitikishak. It means that which makes me plunge in head first, that makes me want to dive into the deep. I want to dive into a dream and get details from inside it. That's what I like to do.
Right. And that, I think our slogan for Natural Dream Work, maybe you'll like it, is we say we don't interpret dreams, we bring them to life. And that has several aspects. One is that we're looking for the living elements in the dream, which would be the moments of revelation or encounter, both in this case with the blue light, but more importantly with the policeman who encounters the person, perhaps. So they can find out, you know, you really don't have to live your life as if you killed somebody and that you're constantly feeling guilty. You know, maybe you're not. But the other piece of that is in the session, we bring the dream to life. In other words, you start with the text or the report, but that's set aside and we restage or reimagine the dream together and deepen our experiences. In reimagining the dream and let's say reinstating it and becoming a presence between us, we can slow it down. We can spend more time over something that might have been skipped over. We can come closer to something, like we might see an event from a balcony. Well, we can move down and get right up against it. I had a client who dreamed of an elk being gored, but she saw it from a balcony. So in the session, I just asked her to move closer to it, and then she felt it, and then she knew it was about her. And that seems to be so important, that we begin to experience our dreams and understand that everything that's happening in the dream, it's happening to us, and we're asked to feel it. So that's a little bit of our approach of bringing the dream to life in the session. As you said, not treating it as a text to analyze, but as an experience to have.
Right. Well, I like that too, Roger. I like that example too. It also leads me to say that from my point of view, dreams are transpersonal as well as personal. So the attitude that everything in the dream is a part of the dreamer, although it's an interesting game to play, is never going to be satisfactory. And you yourself, in your writing at least, talk about they sent the dream. Who are they? What did they want? You went back to the ancient way of understanding that dreams are a field of interaction between the dreamer and other beings, other powers, other intelligences, call them gods, spirits, demons, angels, the departed, the ancestors, etc. I think we're in agreement that there are dreams that are transpersonal, aren't we? That they go beyond what is available to the dreamer by any understanding of what the psyche can contain. They come from somewhere else. Are we in agreement on that or not exactly?
Oh, I think we're in agreement. I would add in the notion of the genius that Keats talks about when he says, you know, what is creative creates itself, and that there's a genius, by which he meant not, as we do today in our ego-driven world, you know, one person is so particularly brilliant and has personal brilliance. No, we mean that there's a force operating that's creative within each of us that is the genius of us. And learn how to learn from that genius and, in a way, sit at the feet of that genius within us. We can reorient ourselves towards the creative imagination that each
right.
of us...
As you know well, Roger, the Romans would never say Roger is a genius. They might say Roger has a genius, has a tutelary creative spirit available to him when he's on. And as a poet, you'll understand this, when he's doing the risky stuff and going out of the comfort zone, then the genius will love him more and come closer, right?
Right. I think we'd agree on the genius. You know, one time I was giving a talk in... Newark, New Jersey. They have a Tibetan, wonderful Tibetan collection at the museum, and they asked me to talk about the Journal Lotus. And I was so tired of giving the same old talk, so I decided I would address the entire talk to a tutelary spirit of Newark, New Jersey. I might have chosen Sarah Vaughan, but I chose Allen Ginsberg. So I just simply addressed the talk to Allen, and everyone else got to listen in.
I love it. We got to take a break, but that's a wonderful note on which to pause. We're talking to Roger Kamenetz. We'll be back after the break with Way of the Dreamer.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Our excellent guest is Roger Kamenetz, author, poet, scholar of dreams, teacher of what he calls natural dream work, great explicator of Jewish mysticism. I must say, Roger, when I was looking for support in the literature for my experiences beyond the body, because you probably know I'm a boy who's pronounced dead twice as a kid and had experiences in other worlds, I looked into the Jewish tradition and I found some interesting texts. I found particularly a Renaissance Italian text by someone called Avraham Hananiah ben Yagel, as I recall, who was thrown into jail in Renaissance Italy, and his father turned up and said, come with me, and dead father. And Avraham in jail said, well, I can't go with you. I've got a body in jail. And his father said, yes, you can come in your body of air. And what unfolded was a whole revelatory journey of heavens and hells and all the rest of it from within the Jewish tradition. I don't know how rare that is as a Jewish document, but I was quite thrilled when I discovered it.
Well, I think what I've learned is that, you know, this ancient tradition that really has a continuity with the ancient world and yet is still very much alive today. It's like a vast storehouse of traditions. And so there's some things that are brought out and more prominently displayed, and there's some hidden things that are less well-known and less widely disseminated. I think it's not that surprising to me that you were able to find some confirmation, because I think everything is in it. But the whole ability of people to access what we might call the esoteric has been somewhat limited historically in Judaism, but that's changing, you know. I mean, that's changed a lot, really, even since 1994 when I wrote the journal Lotus. In fact, that book, I could say immodestly, had some effect in opening.
Oh, yes, I think you're contributing to the efflorescence. Thank you for doing that. And I think our society is opening to the dreams again, and as that happens, we're going to see 1,000 different approaches to dreams flourishing. And I welcome them all, except for the ones that will insist on telling people what their dreams mean in the name of some authority or some guru or some shrink who thinks that he can be the master of dreams. It's very important for me, and perhaps for you too, to understand that the ultimate authority on the dream is the dreamer themselves. It's not anybody else. At the end of the day, you might be clueless about what's going on in your dream. You might need care and tending and special attention and suggestions from frequent flyers. But at the end of the day, if I'm going to be your teacher or guide, I want you, finally, to accept your own power to be author of meaning for your dreams and your life, and not give that away to anybody else who's going to tell you what your dreams or your life means. So everything that I do is actually guided by the idea that the dreamer will take possession of their own dreams and possession of meaning for their own life. I think we're in agreement on that, morally.
Well, I do agree. I think I would bring in Arthur Rimbaud's dictum, of course, which he announced when he was 15, which is, you know, the I is another. And he added, you know, that Wood will discover that it's a violin. So, so this sense of, you're right that the dreamer is the authority, but it's the dreamer not as waking life, ego,
right,
bearer of old stories, but the
right
dreamer as sensual,
right,
immediate feeling, and so forth. So
yes.
The dream can challenge the self-concept of the dreamer. In fact, it often breaks it and dissolves it into a softening, a much greater valuing of feeling and sensuality, and much less of concepts and identification. So
yeah.
if that's my addition to what you're saying, I hope that makes sense. When you say the dreamer, partly the question is what aspect of the dreamer are we talking about? Because if it's a waking world ego, I'm a banker and I expect the dream to affirm my decisions as a corporate master or something.
Well, bankers are dreamers too. Actually, I know an insurance broker who's a very good dreamer. You know some people too. But it is about releasing the deeper self, of course, and finally at the end
right
of the day we hope the understanding will be from that deeper self. But you're a dangerous man, Roger. I loved Rimbaud when I was 16, and I would practice his crazy exercise of trying to see a cathedral at the bottom of a lake to train the imagination. But then, of course, he went off and he became a gun runner and threw all of that stuff away. His life story is not terribly awakening, not terribly enlightening, not terribly uplifting, but nonetheless, what a seductive mind and seductive voice he was. Now, you're a poet. Let's talk briefly about what makes you want to write, what gets you writing, whether you have any practice, or whether there's some way in which you find yourself in the zone. What can you say about that?
Well, I think I've been writing for, you know, poetry seriously since I was about 15, and interestingly, my first book of poetry was called The Missing Jew. And it was really much poetry, 1979 it came out, and it's been a life project. And in fact, I'm happy to say it's going to come out as The Missing Jew Complete in 2019, so 40 years of one project.
Mm.
But really the kind of work I'm doing over the past several years, I longed and longed for a connection between dreaming and poetry, and I tried many approaches. But what I found, and I think I mentioned this before, is that, you know, I'm in the habit of writing down my dreams, as I'm sure you are, and in my case, several times a night. I decided one moment, you know, I could write down the dream, but I think I'll write a poem instead in the feeling that I'm having right now. And that's where I discovered a way of writing poetry from the dream mind, It seems to be working pretty well, and I'm suddenly in this late stage of my life, kind of writing like a 15-year-old again. So
yes.
I was 15 when I first read Rambo. Maybe that's why I was partly inspired.
Yes.
It's coming back.
Yes, it's so important to be in touch with that child or boyhood aspect of oneself. I recently found myself back in touch with a 14-year-old Robert who, over a long, boring, hot summer holiday in Canberra, Australia, a city I detested as a boy, far from the beach, far from the wilderness, sat down every day and banged out 10 pages of a novel on an old stand-up standard typewriter and finished the novel.
Wonderful. That's great.
I'm trying to get back in touch with his energy and discipline, which, although I work fairly hard, I don't have in that manner. I've actually got a miniature standard typewriter on my desk. I'm holding it right now, Robert, Roger, to connect with my 14-year-old Robert in the hope he'll come and help me out.
We do
better when we let the boy, the child self, back in, don't we?
I want him to take over, really.
I love it. Well, we have to take our final break. We'll be back, really, just to say thank you and farewell. We're talking to Roger Cabinets, author of many books of poetry, The Jew and the Lotus, and The History of Last Night's Dream. We'll be back for a moment after the break. This is Way of the Dreamer.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Roger, it's an absolute pleasure to have you for this rambling conversation. I was rambling. You were talking very well. And what a joy to come together on the idea we need to bring back that magical child, that younger self, and bring its creativity and energy into our current lives.
Well, I feel when I talk to you that they are meeting, and you're my dream brother. So thank you so much for having me on this wonderful show. And I hope we did meander and ramble a bit, because that seems the way of the poet, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Well, until next time, my friend, may your best dreams come true. And to everybody listening, may your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.